This is Betty Joram and Joyce Grage. When the River Changes Its Bed, Career Transitions and Midlife, March 1st, 1993.
It's 1993. In our series, The Seasons of Life, we will look this evening at some of the ways that sudden, sometimes traumatic changes are part of the process of individuation. This will be a discussion and lecture and an overview of the process of career transition, the conscious and the unconscious factors affecting career choices, how one finds one's first line of work, influences of complexes that got us there and keep us there, drastic changes in career, questions that arise in response to such changes, and how we can listen to the unconscious responses that hinder and or help through this time.
Went through many of the phases that we're going to be talking about, from the ending of the old and the limbo and the waiting for the beginning of the new. And how many of you have been coming through the series on the Seasons of Life? How many of you have heard one or more of the lectures? Quite a few. So the kinds of things that we're going to be talking about as far as transitions will be echoes of the kind of work, inner work that you've been doing anyway, thinking about this process. Along the way, some other evolutions prior to becoming a therapist, some of the kind of synchronistic things that happened as far as transition in my own life was when I first went to work in New York City after leaving college. I had volunteered all throughout my high school career in the library. And I thought, well, I'll go down and I'll apply at New York Public Library and see if I can pick up something as a clerk. And I walked in, and I had been over the weekend to the funeral of my grandmother. Went into the library personnel office, and the line was out the hall, around the corridor, you know, endless. And finally it got to the desk of the personnel secretary, and she said to me, "You're here in response to the ad in the New York Times." And I started to open my mouth and say, "What ad?" A very kind soul thumped me on the back and said, "They ran a full page in the Sunday Times yesterday." I said, "Yes." And I ended up applying for and got a job in the public library. A lot of things happen that way. And it will be our goal to sort of find out from you and encourage you to look at how change and chance have shaped your life and your career process, and the things that have happened unconsciously that have opened doors and closed others and steer you to where you find yourself. And as you reach this state of transition, hopefully you can make some of the unconscious process conscious and bring that with you to the next, hopefully more conscious decision about where you're going. So I think that's probably enough about me. Turn it over to Joy.
That works, okay. I'll share about myself kind of in the same way and give you a little job history, which may not be as fascinating to you, but it's always been fascinating to me how I got here. When I look at the earliest influences, probably I would look at my family. My very Germanic influences and the fact that I was born female. A very stereotypical German family, I believe, with lots of, the words being obedient and practical and hardworking and responsible. Those were the kinds of values I grew up with, and certainly the legacy from my family. The gender legacy when I was in school, well, the gender legacy started early when I was the neighborhood babysitter, and then I just continued on in helping services. I only knew of two choices for myself. One was teaching and one was nursing. And I started out in nursing because we, in my family, had to go to college, so that wasn't a choice, which I'm glad of, certainly. I started in nursing and hated the University of Washington. I got swallowed by it, and so absolutely having nothing to do with a career choice, I went to Western, which at that point was a college of education. So voila, a teacher. I mean, it had nothing to do with anything I was planning, but sort of what was out there. So I taught school between about 1960 and 1976. And taught and substituted. And my major change, kind of like Betty's way of the dream experience, was being hired to be a substitute in a sixth grade classroom And unbeknownst to me, they had just gotten rid of the previous teacher who had been sent away for a psych eval. And she never came back. So I was the substitute in a classroom that had some of her problems. It was a very bizarre situation, one that I wished I had documented, but didn't. A very, very paranoid classroom of sixth graders. And she's back now. That school that year happened to have their first school counselor. And he walked in and he said, you know, can I help? And I said, I don't know. What'll we do? And so we started together what were called Glasser circles. And Glasser was a therapist who came up with something called reality therapy. And so for the first time in my life, we sat down on the floor with kids and we talked about feelings. And that certainly wasn't a part of my life or my training or anything. And it was pretty astounding. So shortly thereafter, I thought, I would like to be a school counselor. So I went back to school. And about four years later, I got a degree. I was teaching overseas at the time, so this was all sort of off campus or campus overseas. And so I I was almost finished with my degree, and so I charged out to get my first teaching, or my first job with the schools, being a counselor. And I was sure they would snap me up. However, any of those of you who know anything about the military, there are a few rules and regulations, and I didn't fit in the category of school counselors. I was classified as a dependent wife, which is a lovely term. And they wouldn't hire me as a counselor. And I think I was telling Betty that's the first time in my life I'd ever felt homicidal. And so instead of acting on that, I went to a personnel office on a Friday afternoon, and the woman was just coming in to change the job board. And I read a job description, and I thought, well, why not apply? And it was for given I had taught fifth and sixth grade the previous year. So this job said a counselor for an inpatient Army drug and alcohol program. So I had no training, no anything, and I was sure they wouldn't hire me, but that's all there was. So I applied, and I got hired. And if I were to ask how many of you would have thought I had gotten hired, probably not many people would raise their hands. And the person who hired me, I had to ask him why he did. And he said, because you had experience substitute teaching, and anybody who can substitute teach can work with addicts. So that was another rather significant change in my life. Then we came back to the States, and I thought then I would stay in drug and alcohol, and I was either overqualified or underqualified. And I ended up at a mental health institute in Seattle, and I was hired there as a stipend, working with the chronic population, people who had been in Western State and were now living in group homes. Again, I had no experience. I had had no training in this area, but again, I was hired. And I thought that would be a stepping stone for me to work in drug and alcohol. But I ended up staying there 5 years, and it was sort of one of those jobs that was the best of times and worst of times. I left there because of budget cuts and politics, and I got grandfathered in when the state changed its laws about rehab counseling. Once again, I had no training and no experience, and I became a rehab counselor. And worked in, for a while, had several part-time jobs, and then Betty and I ended up in the same program together. And that's where we met, and we had a good time working. I ended up working there 5 years also, and left there because of politics and budget cuts, the same reason. And that led me to pursuing a job in private practice. And during those early years, when I wasn't quite sure which way I was going, I would look at the want ads and look at jobs and agencies and then say, do I want to repeat this? Do I want to reconnect and give my heart and soul to something and have it disappear on me. So I decided not to and have stayed in private practice since then, which for me was a really important choice, and I feel very fortunately that I found a place that I enjoy being. So hopefully that's what you all are looking for, and that can happen. So any questions for Betty or I, given this little history? And because we're going to ask you to do some of the same. So, okay. Do you want to see what I can have? Okay.
I'd like to point out a little bit, we're going to do a lot of audience participation throughout the evening anyway, but I'd like to start out by finding out why some of you were here. Anybody feels inclined to talk? What prompted you to come to this lecture and this workshop? Anybody contemplating a career change? Anybody? Yes?
Mm.
Okay.
Mm.
Yeah. Anybody else? Yes? Mature students returning to school after trauma or loss? Some are career changing because of trauma or loss, and most of these people that he's talking about are women in the 35 to 55 year bracket. Anybody else? Really are based on human psychology. And things like the Strong-Campbell Vocational Interest Inventory and the Career Assessment Inventory and some of these other things are really based on types, with the major exclusion of the introverted intuitives and, to some degree, extroverted intuitives and introverted thinkers, because the job market is not heavily advertising for mystics, psychics, and philosophers. So they're left out of the interest inventories because they're really based on economic demand. Anybody else? Yes. For me to get into and stay in private practice, when I was working with Labor Ministries as a private vocational counselor prior to working for TRAC, every 2 years without fail I lost my income by either a change in the law or change in the policy that the state had mandated. And the interim year, when they neither changed the law nor the policy, they put in a new computerized billing system. And so none of us got paid for 6 months. So I lost my income again. And when I was laid off from TRAC, the last time that was when I decided I wasn't going to be tied to a system like that anymore. And so those outer influences do have a lot of effect on us as far as change. To the person from Boeing, anybody else here from Boeing? So there was a second person. Okay. Sunday's paper had a very large article on the kind of career counseling and advice that Boeing is providing for their employees. And in fact, federal law mandated that employees of major corporations be given 60 days warning notice so that they could prepare for this tremendous shift. A lot of the folks we saw on L&I, on labor industrial insurance, were injured not long before layoff notices were due to go out. And so sometimes that was a major factor in their inability or reluctance or fear of returning to work, is because there was no job to go back to. And that was one of the reasons that they stayed in those systems for such a long time. Another interesting piece of information, an article about Boeing, they said that most people will change jobs 8 times within their career. That doesn't say what happens when you change your career in its entirety. When I first started in this business, career stability was considered to be 10 years employment. That's how long it took you to get vested with a company to get your pension. As I stayed in vocational work, that idea of career stability dropped from 10 years to 5, down to 3, and finally, we were looking at about a year. Somebody having a job for a year at a time was considered to be a stable employee. And I don't know exactly what the data is right now, but you can see that we have a tremendous change and transition going on in our society all the time. It's some enormous percentage of our population that changes jobs, and I read that if people did that in China with the frequency that they do it in America, a billion people would be looking for work all the time. So there's a real resistance to, you know, when you have a job there, it's a job pretty much for life. You're doing what you're supposed to be doing, and there isn't the flexibility. I know somebody's been to China. Is that what I thought of? that you get locked in, you know, to whatever work you're in, and that's it. You really don't have the opportunities we have here for the tremendous amount of growth and change on a personal level.
Okay. Anybody else want to respond? Yes.
So the planning comes Saturday. Too about renewal within a profession. I don't know how much of that specifically we're going to deal with tonight, but certainly the kinds of things we're talking about starting in that process that we will be addressing are things that you would use along the way in that process anyway. 2 hours tonight, we're going to, you know, we're just going to get beginning. And Love It, that's what she said, is the name of the book.
Did you see? Was it out there? Did you see?
No.
Okay.
We can always ask them if we can find it. Yes.
Sure.
I think it's that you would have looked at your work history, and those of you that are contemplating change will have with you some of the tools to continue in that process on your own. And also to assess how much of it, one of the things I guess I found in graduate school was that it confirmed a lot of my own knowledge, and that what I hope is that you'll take with you a sense of how far through this process of change and transition you've already gone. And it'll make it a little easier where there's some uncertainties about what you can expect in the future. I have boxes of resource materials around that I'll be putting out probably on Saturday, like the Dictionary of Occupational Titles, which is a big federal publication, and some other pamphlets and resources where we can actually get into defining specific jobs. But I don't know how much individual one-to-one time we're going to have. But we can also put you in the direction of a lot of community resources where people do career counseling specifically, some of the job lines, you know, information, get more information. We'll have a lot of that because that's what I did for 10 years and just kind of up here. Okay. And we have, I think, in the packets, they're all on every desk, there was a packet of forms, and so that's also going to give you some stuff about the origins of your own work life and also a way to make conscious where you might be going. So I hope that you'll have a general sense of direction. We even have as a final activity in there short-term goals up through the next year where you'd be identifying and working with 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, and 1 year goals as far as things you need to get done to actually accomplish the change you have in mind. And just jumping the gun a bit, for some people it'll be getting education, and for some people it'll be filling out applications. I mean, those are going to be specific for each of you, but you'll have a sense of how to do that. Okay, and makes it more manageable instead of contemplating before, you know.
Or maybe just realizing that, yes, you do want to change jobs. Or maybe some of those who aren't sure. And for me, probably the same thing Betty said, but connections between where you are today and how that's connected with where you've been, and then hopefully leaving with something that will help you move from this point to the next point, whatever that is. And it may be major and it may be minor, but it's movement, and I guess that's what, you know, that's what we hope will happen.
And I think the component that we'll add, given that many of you have been coming to the Yung Society things for a while now, is that there are ways to access the psyche, the information that you get through your dreams and through the unconscious, external hints, which we'll talk about soon, as well as internal information that can help guide you, and ways to integrate that, so that it's going to be very an individual response. You know, as many people are doing in this room are going to take something away different from what we say, but that there'll also be a sense that you have the tools that you need, and if you don't have them, you know where to go to get them. Okay? Because we won't be able to provide all of that in 2 hours and 6 hours on Saturday. We, you know, it won't be that specific, but it'll be hopefully enough.
Okay. So, Betty said something about a guide. So I am going to guide you on a guided imagery experience. And I realize these chairs aren't real conducive to relaxation, but please kind of do your best. And again, this is related to your work history. And we're going to start at the river's source where Betty and I first began all this and take you downstream. So one thing before we start, I may ask, or you may want to jot down notes, observation, not while I'm doing it, but images after this is over. So just have a pencil out if you feel like you might want to do that and you won't have to rummage through your things. Okay? So, first of all, find a comfortable position in your chair, if you can, and begin to relax your body by paying attention to your breathing. Notice the motion in your chest and abdomen as you breathe deeply in and out, and feel the warm air run through you. Let your eyes close if that is comfortable, and feel the warm air relaxing any tense muscles in your face, your jaw, your neck and shoulders, and feel the warm air gradually move downward. As you exhale, feel the tension flow out and continue to feel your muscles relax in your arms, your abdomen, pelvis, legs, and feet. Continue to breathe and feel your body become warm and relaxed. Now, in your mind's eye, imagine that you are standing at the source, the very source of a river, at a place where the water is just beginning to gently flow. And imagine that this river is the route you have taken as you have traveled through your various work and career settings. You will be traveling downstream on this river, and at this place where you are standing, you will find a boat in a shallow eddy in which to make this journey. In your mind's eye, walk over to the boat, get in, and when you are comfortably seated, feel the boat draw away from the shoreline and gradually enter the river's current. For the next few minutes, you're going to travel this river from its source when you first began working, downstream to your present work situation, taking time to stop and recall past job experiences. Notice where you go ashore, which currents generally take you there. And when you leave a job, what draws you away? Of the various work experiences you've had, which have given you the most joy? And which have caused the most pain and disappointment? When has the river's path felt safest? When has it felt too fast and treacherous? And where have you felt caught in water that is slow and stagnant? What obstacles have you overcome? And who are the significant people who have accompanied you? And what about your present situation is influencing you to consider a new possible direction? Now feel the boat slowly approach the shoreline, a place today where you feel safe and sheltered, a stopping place on this journey where you can drop anchor and feel warmed and comforted by the sun. Allow yourself to breathe deeply. And notice how you are feeling after this first leg of your journey. Now, from this safe, sheltered place, in your mind's eye, turn your head and look downriver in the direction you are about to travel. How far downriver can you see? What are your hopes? What are your fears? How long do you think this journey might take? And what are you doing to prepare for it? Take some time to reflect on these questions and notice your feelings as you think about this new journey before you. And when you are ready, find yourself returning to this classroom, slowly becoming aware of the lights, the place you are sitting, the people around you. And take a few minutes to record any images or observations, memories that you'd like to make. I was kind of go back again, making these connections. And a question of you in terms of going back is, how did you find some of your first lines of work? How did you end up in the jobs? Why did you end up in the jobs that some of you ended up in? What were the influences? What were the factors that got you there? Yeah. Supposed to be. Ooh, raise your hand. Any of you chose careers because you wanted to do the exact opposite of what your family did? Which is another great reason. How many of you as children knew what you wanted to be when you grew up? Or had a thought anyway that, you know, when I grow up I want to be. How many of you had that? Yeah. That was the next question. And how many of you became what you wanted to be when you were children? What do you do? You want to be a mommy. And you are. Great. The pay's not good. Oh. This, I guess what I'm aware of when I explain my job history is that the pieces are fascinating in terms of why we end up, and you know, through dreams and images and fate and luck and hard work and whatever all that is. And something that has really struck me, I have a daughter who's now she's 29 and totally confused about what she wants to be when she grows up, and she is overwhelmed by the choices, whereas when I was growing up, I was underwhelmed by the choices. And we both were stuck with that. And for her now, there's so many choices, she doesn't hardly know where to begin. Yes? Why One of the things about all this is, I guess what we came to realize, and maybe you knew it before I did, that very few people consciously make career choices. And that's what we hope this experience will kind of bring together, is a greater consciousness, awareness, both of the unconscious and other issues, to help you decide what to do in all of this. Most of us do it by hit and miss, kind of. So we hope to kind of get further into what the possibilities are for you.
I think that what we have on the board has covered most of the information that I had in my outline, which is not in your packet. Almost everything else we're going to talk about is in your packet. But just to run over some of the things and maybe summarize, some of the things I thought of when putting this together is, how do we find our first line of work? Family background, which we've certainly explored tonight. Family expectations, like who will or who won't go to college. Nobody's ever gone to college before, or everybody always goes to college in this family, or whatever that is. I know in my family it wasn't if you go, it's when you go. You know, and it just was implied. I think Joyce mentioned the same for her. Sometimes it's personal choice, sometimes it's opportunity, which we have here. Opportunity can mean money, it can mean education, it can mean other things to you. My first private rehab job was standing at a professional association meeting talking to a former colleague, and they said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I just got my master's, and my job just ended because the grant ran out, and the person in my temporary job came back to her permanent job." And this guy overheard the conversation. He said, "I'm looking for a consultant." You know, dumb luck, right? Happens a lot. And that started me in private practice. And I think when I'd been in school, somebody said, 5 years from now, you'll have a private practice. I would have laughed at them because I didn't have the self-concept to envision that for me. Life circumstances also affect. How many people took a job because they got married and suddenly found they had a family they had to support? Anybody in that circumstance? A few. Okay, and so sometimes that shapes your possibilities and your options, and you don't realize what got away. Children also change the opportunities that people find themselves. If somebody has a healthy child or somebody has a child with a disability, it can alter significantly your economic situation, the kind of choices you make. You begin choosing jobs for insurance rather than jobs where they're fun and have a lot of flexibility. Economic reality, again, a number of people mentioned that one. How many chose job for job security? My husband came back here. He'd been working in electronics for a while and did electronics in the military. And Boeing was in the midst of a massive layoff back in the late 60s, and he went to work for Metro because he felt it was a recession-proof occupation. He's been there for 19 years. Right? He's also, in the last 6 or 7 years, gone back to become a sculpture major at the University of Washington. And so he's finally found something else that he would really rather be doing. But for a long time, he didn't exactly know, and he spent probably half of that time building our house. And so these things all affect the kind of choices that we make and where we see ourselves. But I don't think his first inner identity was, "I'm going to be a bus driver for the rest of my life." But there he is, you know. So I want to talk a little bit next about the complexes, since we're in the Jung Society and we've talked about the unconscious a lot. How many people have some vague idea of what I mean when I say complex? Okay, anybody have a definition they want to offer? What's a complex?
The black hole.
Okay. I'm going to read you a brief definition of the complex, of a complex. First of all, Jung's definition of a complex is a little different than Freud's. For Freud, when you got into the unconscious, you got as far as the complex, and that's all there was. For Jung, a complex is a charged energy center in the psyche, but the core of the complex is not your personal experience. It's what Jung called the archetype. So I'm just going to talk briefly about two of the many complexes you might find, the mother and the father complex. Definition. The complexes are a content of the unconscious which is incompatible with the habitual attitude of consciousness. Like, I'm not usually like this, right? Until the complex is surrounded by some strong emotion and functions autonomously to produce disturbances of memory and to influence speech and action. It may appear in dreams in personified form. So it makes us act in suddenly altered ways from our normal way of being in the world. Okay? It's a very charged and potent thing. I think using the paper and being overprepared.
Where is it?
Complex has influenced the kind of work that we do to a greater extent than we'd like to realize. Our attitudes about ourselves and what kind of work we do are formed very early by our parents' opinions of us. And those complexes that come from our parents' opinions and how we experience our own self-esteem affect the choice of jobs, like I think I can do that or I don't think I can do that. I don't think I'm good enough. I could never be a whatever. Those things can happen really early on if the influences upon us are somewhat negative and tinged with a lot of criticism. On the other hand, the parental complexes, when they're benevolent, can really further the growth of the individual. Of course you can be whatever you want to be. My stepdaughter had posters in her room of Sally Ride and was really convinced that she could become an astronaut. She joined the service. I won't say a whole lot about that, but reality is dishing her up a little bit something that she had expected, and she's finding that her life has taken another turn. And it's not that she won't ever get back on track, but she'll have learned something along the way, that her early expectations that she could be anything she wanted are going to be also altered by life and circumstance. But, you know, when you raise children, sometimes they get that feeling that they really can go out and conquer the world, and sometimes they're left somehow feeling that, no, they could never do that. They could never know what to do. Some of the other things, aside from self-esteem, that might not be so readily apparent or easy to identify, the complexes can be activated at work by intense flare-ups of personal relationships that somebody might have either with a coworker or some incident that happens on the job or towards the organization itself. It can be a sudden comment, and all of a sudden, a person's whole equilibrium is disturbed, and they feel really negative or distressed about an incident that happened. And that's another marker of the complex showing up in the psyche. Organizations, too, take on archetypal or parental god or goddess-like qualities. School, for instance, which we call alma mater, means our foster mother. And when I was working at the placement center at the University of Washington, I worked with a man who was in his 30s, who was finishing a PhD program in classical Chinese poetry, was 38 years old. He had never not been to school. He had no idea what it would be like to function outside of the university environment, to get a job and to be employable in the outside world. He was terribly frightened, but he was really caught in the mother complex of the security of school and everything that that provided. In our experience in working with labor and industries, and also I've worked with clients on Social Security, these organizations and systems often function as pseudo-parents. And I found that if people had relatively functional relationships with their parents, even if they found themselves injured and out of work, they could access the benign parental qualities of an organization like labor and industries and be dependent for a while and then regain their sense of independence and go back out into the world. Where the family history was really dysfunctional, a lot of alcoholism or multiple divorces or whatever had happened, a lot of times the organization took on the role of hostile parent, and we had lots of issues that got named behaviorally about noncompliance, and people had their benefits cut, and there was a lot of resistance to them getting off of these systems. And so jobs can function in the same way, where a lot of transference issues come back and forth in the job that really don't have to do with the job itself. They have to do with the relationship of the person's psyche, perhaps with the psyche of their boss or coworker, or the projections about the organization that they work for as a parent. And companies like IBM, I don't know how exactly it is for Boeing, but where there's a really intact corporate culture, also function in a parental way, where they provide lots of benefits and job security with the expectation then that what you give up to the organization is your individuality and your creativity, even to the point that the company owns the patents on any creative work that people do. I see the copyright person. Somebody's sitting here nodding away that you have experience with that. They own your inventions. They own the product of your mind as well as your hours on the job. And sometimes people find that very frustrating, very limited, but they don't realize that it's the double edge for having all of that job security. One of the things we've seen, especially through the 80s, and I'm sure now again in the 90s, is that the corporations aren't going to be such completely benevolent and long-enduring parents, that the layoffs, the early retirements, change of corporate structure are forcing a lot of people back out into the job market who never thought they'd have to be there. And it causes tremendous shifts in people to encounter them. One of my students, when I taught at Antioch a couple of summers ago, also wrote about her job in a paper that was, I found, really insightful and really fascinating. We had been talking about the complexes, and she had written that she ran a daycare business, and she kept looking for her job to provide for her the love and attention she never received from her mother. The paradox of running such a company and having that kind of a transference is that you really have to tend the business and be the parent of the company, rather than the company becoming your parent, especially in something small like daycare where you have employees and you've got lots of children. And she very, very interestingly wrote about how she was able to shift over the course of the quarter in her expectations, that she was not looking to her own job to provide for her the kind of parenting that she never received. And that can also happen, that people look and work with these transferences, have expectations that they will be getting emotional needs met. And then they wonder why they're frustrated, and they wonder why they're bored. And I wonder if that doesn't help the person who asked about burnout. If you're working with a lot of people who are burned out, to re-examine the fundamental expectations that they have about what they give the job and what the job owes them, aside from the dollars, in return. And a lot of times it's that, because it's a tremendously frustrating experience. I found it really fascinating that she had chosen it to look at the complex in that way. I think that if some of the things that we can do over the next week as we work through these exercises is look at the binding and suffocating as well as the nurturing and life-giving aspects of these complexes, we can find the courage it takes to stand somewhat independently of them and make decisions that are not based only on that reactive space where the charge that the complex brings is so intense that you really can't see straight. And if you can do that, then you connect with the more numinous power and the freeing power. Rather than only with one side of the archetype, you're able to access some things perhaps you didn't have in your personal experience with your own parents and have some energy to bring back out into the world again. Does anybody have any questions? Comments?
What it makes me think of, too, in another language, kind of this family of origin work, when we go out into the workplace and sort of recreate our own family of origin, which is also is what Betty's saying. And I certainly had an executive director once who was certainly felt like my father, and at the time that made no sense to me, but we certainly also played out some dynamics between us, and now in retrospect it makes a lot of sense. So it's important to look for those kind of things. Yeah. Why don't we take a break?
Having the potential to be a benevolent parental complex, one of the things that we did as vocational rehab counselors was help people access ways of benefiting from their benefits, basically, instead of seeing the benefits as so onerous and punitive that if you didn't do this, this, and this, you would have them taken away, of seeing them, okay, you have these for this period of time. Let's see what you can do while you have this chance to heal and recover. You know, so you've been injured, and we have to, now that becomes a fact, right, that maybe wasn't a fact in your life before. How can you then access what the system has to offer you, you know, like perhaps money for education or a chance to rethink if you can't stay in your old line of work, what you might like to do with your life. And for people who've never contemplated that or always had the expectation that it would go on indefinitely and then suddenly have it traumatically ended, that process of rethinking what to do with their life was something that actually having the state require that they come to the program that Joyce and I worked in was in a way a benefit that they wouldn't have had otherwise, you know. And so for them to be able to access counseling or access educational funds or access job retraining from their employer, for instance, if they couldn't go back to their old work, that became a way to develop some kind of a healthier or stronger, kinder relationship with the parent rather than just the punitive one that they were used to. A lot of companies do offer retraining benefits. I know when I was doing all that kind of work, Shepherd Ambulance made it a requirement that everybody who came to work for them have another career in mind, because to work in ambulance care where you had to lift patients and get into emergency situations and carry heavy loads and do lots of lifting, the longer a person stayed beyond 6 or 9 months, the higher the likelihood that they would suffer severe back injury. And they wanted to make sure that people didn't think they could have this job forever, because physically it wasn't going to be there for them. So they encouraged people to do some sort of education while they were working for this company. They provided lots of benefits. So, and that's the way that an employer can become a healthier component of the system. Okay. Any other comments about the complexes or anything else we talked about? Yes.
As the workforce seems to be moving more towards work communities, and you don't have the hierarchy of a manager, but it seems like we're getting more into like sibling stuff.
Sibling
what's
stuff.
What's the complex around sibling stuff? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, brother sister rivalry
stuff.
Yeah. Freud had a lot to say about that one, didn't he? About the older child wanting to murder the younger child. That's Freud's whole theory of sibling rivalry and jealousy. Archetypally, some of the myths, Apollo and Diana had certain kind of bond, but also a certain rivalry in their relationships and in the kind of things that they did. They were competitors as well. So the way that people respond to the brother-sister constellation is interesting. Or brother-brother. Fratricide, you know, Jacob and Esau, we go back. Okay, that kind of rivalry. Who gets the blessing of the father? I mean, there's endless stories, you know. Other ways to work it out. Yes?
Complexes and archetypes are, let's say, a result or a process, a result of years and years of human putting on something. And complex is the way you think for a year, or therefore the result of that. But nothing is fixed.
As I've experienced this organization, the lectures that have been here, it's one of the things that's nice is to be able to access the archetype of the wise old man or the wise old woman, the Senex energy, that it's in that place of wisdom. And we've really lost a lot of touch with that. I've been reading a number of things where they talk about just contemporary television where the parent generation is really ridiculed. Fathers are put down, you know. And there's all this kind of thing where we don't access the wisdom of people who've endured and lived long and witnessed lots of change in a particular field of endeavor. And yet, in science, you know, sometimes it's the longevity that gives people those great discoveries, that they've really stuck to the tasks that they've done. I think that's not just in science, but in any field. I know, I just remember reading in my rehab journals about people started, you know, in different parts of the country when there were no rehab laws and they were itinerant and they went from little community to little community, you know, and helped people gradually go back to work. And they've been in the field as the laws evolve and help to shape them and to see the kind of change, you know. So there's a lot to be said for staying in one place, but you have to, if it's not validated in the outer world, find the inner resource that acknowledges its validity. It's a real important thing.
When you said that, I thought it would depend on kind of which generation you spoke to, because there would be people who would honor that, certainly. And it also seems like things are in such transition now that we are in the process of rethinking, remaking our rituals, which is a big issue with that.
Either one of those, but I think you need to look at it in the context of that total individual. You know, and the feeling I certainly got working with this person was it was definitely, there was a, you know, a complex that was, and he was terribly frightened. And that kind of fear meant that he really hadn't resolved the relationship with that system that he was in. It was a, still a very much, you could feel, the dependent relationship. But sometimes, you know, it's one's neurosis that makes one do the most creative work. You know, it, you don't know, right?
Oh.
I guess when I think of doing this kind of work, I always think of and, rather than this or that, rather than to block a possibility. Always include and be more inclusive in my thinking about it. Otherwise, it's so easy to get judgmental and lose the fact, lose something that might really be of intrinsic value to the person. I'm glad you brought it out. I want to say a little bit about the packets that everybody got and they're sitting on your desk. And we'll move into the next section here. What we've done so far tonight is look at really the first worksheet, Returning to the Source, and some influential factors. The second page, the way it was collated, really should be the fourth page. Exploring the landmarks should logically, we don't have to be logical, but logically it should come after the lifeline, because it really asks you to look in depth at the kinds of things that you mark on there. The opening guided imagery that Joyce did gives you an idea of what might go on the lifeline. And I would encourage any, how many of you have read or looked at Women Who Run with the Wolves? Yay. Okay, there's a chapter she talks about this concept, marking the crosses of the things that died along the way. Essentially, that's a wonderful image to go with the lifeline. And so I've included both the positive and the negative. Look at the things that that have gone well for you in your life and the choice points, and look at the things that you've really had to leave behind. Okay.
And also, how many of you have read Transitions by Bridges?
There you go.
Another excellent
the
book.
The other companion book. Those two. Okay. Some of the worksheets, what we'd like for you to do if you're coming back on Saturday is to do as many of these as you can, or do what you can, and we'll be working, spending some time to have people write and do some thinking about it then. But to prepare yourself to have some of this accomplished. And as I said, we're going over some of these things tonight, so we're going to give you a jump start on it, and then we'll be working with them on Saturday. If there are any questions so far about anything we've done, or...
There will be some time on Saturday, but hopefully you will have gone through most of this so that as a group we can... work as a group together and go through some of the exercises. We probably won't go through all of them, but the ones that seem most pertinent.
And if you're not coming back and you're still in the middle of change or thinking about it, do them anyway over time, as you have time to think this through, whatever's gotten started in you tonight, work with that. And Bridges' book on transitions is really an excellent companion to this. So, yes?
Could you possibly go over
what's the name
of it?
Okay. We'll probably spend quite a bit of time, I would think, on Saturday on this one, but the kinds of things that I was just talking about the complexes, and just the things, even if you don't want to label them as complexes, things that you know that you've done yourself. When I first got up to Seattle, I thought that I wanted to major in physical therapy, and I was, in fact, I've been in a program in Oregon at a two-year college to that end, but I wasn't happy with the two-year program. I really wanted a professional degree. And I was volunteering with the Cerebral Palsy Society here, taking disabled adults swimming a couple of times a month, I think once a week. And I had my interview for the PT program, which is down at University Medical School in the Health Sciences Building. I had my interview one day for that degree program, and I had been swimming with all these folks, and I came in my sort of hippie dress, and my hair was all wet, and essentially I sabotaged the interview. I didn't ask the therapist that I was working with for a reference and a couple of things like that. So when we get to these real crunch points in our life and we have choices and options, looking at the ways in which we do things unconsciously has an effect on where we end up, okay? Like my saying yes when the person said, "Have you answered the ad in the newspaper?" even though I didn't know about it, also had an influence on my life. those kinds of things, you know, and how you respond under certain kinds of stress. I mean, I remember a track when it was sort of ending, and they were going from running 6 work behavior programs in a month to not enough referrals to run 1. It was absolute disaster around there, and I know that my reactions were more out of the complex than they were as a professional. You know, it was really a deadly time. You know, I had been for a while treated as a non-person by my supervisors, and they would walk in and they knew we weren't getting enough business, but nobody would tell me I was going to be laid off. You know, and you begin to have strange responses when you're treated for a long period of time as a non-being, you know, even though I was working real hard with the clients. And so that's the kind of thing I think that we're looking for.
Yeah, and how do you respond to stress? How do you respond to change? How many of you get sick? What are your vulnerabilities? How many of you drink a little more, or sleep a little more, or eat a little more, or do you have a support system that you go to? So this is the kind of these are kind of choices that we make, sometimes conscious, sometimes unconscious, to pay attention to.
Does that help?
No.
No.
Okay.
Do you have a more specific question?
It does help.
What really it requires is that you think about you rather than me giving you what I do under adverse conditions or healthy conditions. You really need to look at what you do, things that work for you, and things that you know further your own demise. Right? And that's individual. Some of that, when we get through working in a group, you'll find is very similar, but some of it's going to be unique to you. And then you can begin to see maybe some of the archetypal stuff that's underneath it, too.
Mm-hmm. What do you do when the water gets rough? What do you do when it's stagnant? So those kinds of things.
Panic or go fishing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I wanted to cover tonight still was actually referring to the title of this presentation, When the River Changes Its Bed. And maybe this will answer some of those questions and things. What kind of unconscious choices happen that force us into a change, whether we would like to have it or not? Okay.
You mean to write?
What I mean when I say unconscious choice, I mean, the layoff question has been up here, so wouldn't that be a first logical answer? People get laid off. Businesses close. Okay? Employers relocate. Okay. Any others that we can think of, unconscious choice? Illness in the family or illness of oneself? Mm-hmm. Right. Financial responsibility change. Boredom. You said boredom. Boredom is an How to explain how you see boredom as an unconscious choice? Wellness? Wellness. Okay. You want to expand on that? What, to repeat what he just said, when one heals oneself and becomes well, there's often an unconscious attitude change toward employment about what work you can stand to do or not. What you want, what you would like to do. I work that both ways with the process of elimination of all. Also, there are things I will never go back to. You know, I could have had a job working in rehab in Olympia. I would wash dishes in a nursing home in Seattle before I would go take an administrative job in rehab in Olympia. It's just, it's that clear. I won't do it. You know, it would, somebody would get hurt. I just assumed I'd be myself and my family. Okay. Anything else? Yeah, please. Well, it's the speaking of the collective unconscious in that instance, right? But, and we do get those messages from the collective that we're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Okay? And layoff is a very collective experience. And a lot of people are going through that right now with the economy. I have done job placement in some really tough economic times in this town. You know, and it really affects a lot of people. And one of the nice things about working in groups with people then is that they don't feel so alone with it, like it's only happening to me. You know, it's a collective phenomenon. And it changes individuals tremendously. Okay, a couple of other ones. I'll read from my list. People quit. They don't know why. They just up and quit. I can't stand it anymore. Sometimes they get fired. And that's a message from the unconscious, a big time message, that they aren't, something's wrong. Right? Yes?
Well, having my own business, my attitude goes wrong.
So no work. Attitude, your attitude affects the work you do. Yeah. So you get the message from the unconscious. What I have parenthetically about fired is what shadow? Who, me? Anybody know their shadow? Anybody ever have an encounter with a shadow? A few people. There is nothing like something like that to bring you into consciousness or connection with your own unconscious attitudes. And that's usually a real big shock to the system. And some people don't get it, and so they get fired, and they get fired, and they get fired. You know, we used to work with guys that they were really God's gift to the labor force, and you just wouldn't want to be around them for very long. You know, the attitude was so abrasive and so aversive. Another kind of symptom, and it is related to your statement about boredom that I had down here, is restless. Just kind of a restlessness about what's going on. You're unhappy, but you're still there. And so that's a message from the unconscious. I used to know that when I couldn't get up in the morning on a regular basis and I had to drag myself by the arm into work, I really was, it was time to get out of there. You know? And the other one, which Joyce and I encountered endlessly, was injury. People got injured on the job. When it's time to change, the risk, when the unhappiness is up, and the boredom is up, and the restlessness is up, and people don't pay attention to that, usually they end up working more overtime, and the stress goes up on the job, and that's about the time a person's going to get hurt. We saw people thrown off ropes, you know, you name it, drop down holes, lifted something wrong, and they just got hurt. And that was an unconscious, had an unconscious influence on what they were then going to do with the rest of their life.
Okay. Oh, yeah. We don't have much more. It's about 9:30. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay.
Just one of that. What we're trying to figure out is how much longer. We're kind of getting to the end of the evening, and we want to get into a little bit more stuff.
Well, yeah, you just want to talk a little bit about dreams, so people bring that in, and so we're sort of winding down. How don't we do that?
The other thing in terms of looking at just where we might be in these handouts. Okay. The third page, the impact of career transitions. What happens at about this time when these unconscious factors have come into play, if a person hasn't made a conscious decision to leave and to go find something else to do, but they find themselves suddenly out of work or between things, all the major questions of life surface. Where am I now? What am I now? Who am I now? Sometimes the best way to figure that out is to go back, as we've begun this evening. Where was I? What was I? Who was I? And then we can come to the questions of where am I going, what am I going to do, and who will I become? At this point in time, speaking from the relationship of the conscious to the unconscious, the old persona, the old shadow, the onum and the onimus, those of you who are all familiar with the terminology, they don't work well anymore. Pretty much the old gray mare, she ain't what she used to be. And so it's time then to reevaluate. And one enters, having left the old world, as we've been hearing all through this season on the seasons of life, one leaves the old, the known, and the familiar, and enters into that phase of initiation where you're removed from what you once knew. You enter into a time of limbo when all of these questions come up and there's more questions than there are answers. Okay, so in a very active way, we're taking all that stuff that's been coming out here through this whole series of programs and saying, this is where you find yourself now when you enter into the place of career transition and you're between jobs. You're literally in that archetypal space between worlds. You are not who you were, and you are not yet who you will become. The experience during that time is a lot of chaos, so sometimes it helps just to know that there's a lot of chaos, and so you don't panic under that circumstance. Okay? But that's where we're going to ask you to spend this next week, those of you who are coming back, those of you who are contemplating this major change or in it. Anyway, contemplate the chaos in which you find yourself. Okay? And it's out of that point that it really helps to pay attention and listen to the psyche. I would really encourage, in addition to all of this cognitive homework, that over this next week, and perhaps for subsequent weeks, that you keep track of your dreams. How many of you do that anyway? Oh, great. Okay, so it won't be so hard. Those of you who've never done it, the first requirement is to sleep. Those of you going to school and working two jobs may not be able to do that, so you have to watch it. And just keep a paper and pencil by your bed, and you don't have to wake yourself up all through the night, but just catch whatever comes through. You know, keep your book where it's handy. If you have somebody else that you have to take consideration of in the bed so that you don't wake them, let them know that what you'll be doing, and have a place sometime during the morning where you can jot them down. Try and catch them, because they really are quite informative. What I'd like to talk about a little bit is the kind of dreams that I have seen come up during this period of time. I've worked with a lot of students who are graduating from very, very rigorous programs. As they near graduation, the dreams that come up as they're about to embark on their career path have a lot to do with rebirth. Very, very powerful symbols of regeneration. For my own self, when I left the job at Track and hadn't built my practice up to the point where it would sustain me, I found myself every Sunday reading the Sunday paper, and my husband was really, you know, you got to get a job. And I didn't know what to do, and I had a dream that I was back in New York, where I'm from, standing on the stoop of an old brownstone building. And there was a guy in the middle of the street, and he came up to me and he said, "You know that law that they passed about rounding up anybody standing in the street for loitering just so they can catch drug traffickers? So that's a bad law, because they catch a lot of innocent people." And the message to me was it was okay to stand in the doorway and look up and down the street to see what was going on. And sometimes it's that kind of message, even when you don't know, that can guide you through this time of transition. It's really important to pay attention to what's going on in your unconscious, because that's where the reserve comes from if you're committed to making change. What happens is that the psyche in its entirety begins to be committed to that process so that you can express more aspects of the self when the old ways are really worn out. When John Muir Perry was here, anybody hear his lecture a couple of years ago? He gave a very interesting lecture. He was talking about psychosis and the program he used to run in San Francisco. And he talked about a young man who was working in Silicon Valley and came into the clinic with a psychotic break, and he kept talking about this dream that a fleet of Buddhist monks was invading San Francisco Bay. And they were trying to figure out what this was. And this guy had a job 9 to 5 in Silicon Valley, or one of those places out there on the electronics strip, and he was in engineering, I guess. And he really, really deeply wanted to go and become a monk and learned to meditate, but he was tied to this 9-to-5 job with a wife and 2.5 kids in a car and a mortgage, and he couldn't do it. He didn't think he could do it. And so the message from the unconscious that he also had a spiritual side appeared to him as just an invading army of monks, you know. And so if you can listen to the psyche, it can tell you what's most strong. And the longer you resist, the harder you close your eyes and grit your teeth against something you really want to do, the more forceful method the psyche will choose to show it to you. I call it the frying pan method, you know. It's going to come up and hit you over the back of the head. So if you're feeling a lot of tension in your body, a lot of back pain, a lot of neck pain, a lot of teeth grinding. Well, we used to feel their heels were dug into the floor. They all had low back injuries. You know, they were just like being pulled by this bronco. That's the kind of message where you can perhaps ameliorate a little bit. A little bit like the last fairy in Sleeping Beauty, you know, after the curse is cast on Sleeping Beauty that she'll die. Well, they just soften the blow and she can do it for, she can sleep for 100 years. You know, if you can listen, perhaps you can soften the kind of impact that life might have in store if you're really full out resistance. You can't always, we don't know what that's about. But also these things change you and they open your eyes to other possibilities.
So do what makes sense in the exercises we gave you, and some of them may seem very relevant and some may not, and that's okay. If you want to do all of them, fine, and if you don't have a lot of time, we'll have some time on Saturday, and then we'll meet and go through that packet.
And I have, and I hope we get some time to spend with some of the, what I would call, how many of you know what type you are? People know types? Okay. Anybody real sensation-focused type? A lot of intuitives and feelers? We're going to spend time with your inferior function. So we're going to talk about that because I've got lots of data from my old life. Books and things and, you know, paper and pencil stuff. And you can look at numbers and you can look at forms. And we'll work with some of that on Saturday. To get a job and to be employable in the outside world. He was terribly frightened, but he was really caught in the mother complex of the security of school and everything that that provided. In our experience in working with labor and industries, and also I've worked with clients on Social Security, these organizations and systems often function as pseudo-parents. And I found that if people had relatively functional relationships with their parents, even if they found themselves injured and out of work, they could access the benign parental qualities of an organization like labor and industries and be dependent for a while and then regain their sense of independence and go back out into the world. Where the family history was really dysfunctional, a lot of alcoholism or multiple divorces or whatever had happened, a lot of times the organization took on the role of hostile parent, and we had lots of issues that got named behaviorally about noncompliance. And people had their benefits cut, and there was a lot of resistance to them getting off of these systems. And so jobs can function in the same way, where a lot of transference issues come back and forth in the job that really don't have to do with the job itself. They have to do with the relationship of the person's psyche, perhaps with the psyche of their boss or coworker, or the projections about the organization that they work for as parent. And companies like IBM, I don't know how exactly it is for Boeing, but where there's a really intact corporate culture, also function in a parental way, where they provide lots of benefits and job security with the expectation then that what you give up to the organization is your individuality and your creativity, even to the point that the company owns the patents on any creative work that people do. I see the copyright person. Somebody's sitting here nodding away that you have experience with that. They own your inventions. They own the products of your mind as well as your hours on the job. And sometimes people find that very frustrating, very limited, but they don't realize that it's the double edge for having all of that job security. One of the things we've seen, especially through the 80s, and I'm sure now again in the 90s, is that the corporations aren't going to be such completely benevolent and long-enduring parents, that the layoffs, the early retirements, change of corporate structure are forcing a lot of people back out into the job market who never thought they'd have to be there. And it causes tremendous shifts in people to encounter that. One of my students, when I taught at Antioch a couple of summers ago, also wrote about her job in a paper that was, I found, really insightful and really fascinating. We had been talking about the complexes, and she had written that she ran a daycare business, and she kept looking for her job to provide for her the love and attention she never received from her mother. the paradox of running such a company and having that kind of a transference is that you really have to tend the business and be the parent of the company rather than the company becoming your parent, especially in something small like daycare where you have employees and you've got lots of children. And she very, very interestingly wrote about how she was able to shift over the course of the quarter in her expectations, that she was not looking to her own job to provide for her the kind of parenting that she never received. And that can also happen, that people look and work with these transferences, have expectations that they will be getting emotional needs met. And then they wonder why they're frustrated, and they wonder why they're bored. And I wonder if that doesn't help the person who asked about burnout. If you're working with a lot of people who are burned out, to re-examine the fundamental expectations that they have about what they give the job and what the job owes them, aside from the dollars, in return. And a lot of times it's that, because that's a tremendously frustrating experience. I found it really fascinating that she had chosen it to look at the complex in that way. I think that if some of the things that we can do over the next week as we work through these exercises is look at the binding and suffocating as well as the nurturing and life-giving aspects of these complexes, we can find the courage it takes to stand somewhat independently of them and make decisions that are not based only on that reactive space where the charge that the complex brings is so intense that you really can't see straight. And if you can do that, then you connect with the more numinous power and the freeing power. Rather than only with one side of the archetype, you're able to access some things perhaps you didn't have in your personal experience with your own parents and have some energy to bring back out into the world again. Does anybody have any questions? Comments?
What makes me think of, too, in another language, kind of this family of origin work, when we go out into the workplace and sort of recreate our own family of origin, which is also is what Betty's saying. And I certainly had an executive director once who was certainly felt like my father, and at the time that made no sense to me, but we certainly also played out some dynamics between us, and now in retrospect it makes a lot of sense. So it's important to look for those kind of things. Yeah. Why don't we take a break?
We should probably take a break. Having the potential to be a benevolent parental complex, one of the things that we did as vocational rehab counselors was help people access ways of benefiting from their benefits, basically, instead of seeing the benefits as so onerous and punitive that if you didn't do this, this, and this, you would have them taken away. Of seeing them, okay, you have these for this period of time. Let's see what you can do while you have this chance to heal and recover. You know, so you've been injured and we have to, now that becomes a fact, right? That maybe wasn't a fact in your life before. How can you then access what the system has to offer you? You know, like perhaps money for education or a chance to rethink if you can't stay in your old line of work, what you might like to do with your life. And for people who've never contemplated that or always had the expectation that it would go on indefinitely and then suddenly have it traumatically ended, that process of rethinking what to do with their life was something that actually having the state require that they come to the program that Joyce and I worked in was in a way a benefit that they wouldn't have had otherwise. You know, and so for them to be able to access counseling or access educational funds or access job retraining from their employer, for instance, if they couldn't go back to their old work, that became a way to develop some kind of a healthier or stronger, kinder relationship with a parent rather than just the punitive one that they were used to. A lot of companies do offer retraining benefits. I know when I was doing all that kind of work, Shepherd Ambulance made it a requirement that everybody who came to work for them have another career in mind, because to work in ambulance care where you had to lift patients and get into emergency situations and carry heavy loads and do lots of lifting, the longer a person stayed beyond 6 or 9 months, the higher the likelihood that they would suffer severe back injury. And they wanted to make sure that people didn't think they could have this job forever because physically it wasn't going to be there for them. So they encouraged people to do some sort of education while they were working for this company. They provided lots of benefits. So, and that's the way that an employer can become a healthier component of the system. Okay. Any other comments about the complexes or anything else we talked about? Yes.
As the workforce seems to be moving more towards work teams, and you don't have this hierarchy of, a manager, but it seems like we're getting more into like sibling stuff.
Sibling
what's
stuff.
What's the complex around sibling stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, brother sister rivalry stuff. Yeah, Freud had a lot to say about that one, didn't he? About the older child wanting to murder the younger child. That's Freud's whole theory of sibling rivalry and jealousy. Archetypally, some of the myths, Apollo and Diana had certain kind of bond, but also a certain rivalry in their relationships and in the kind of things that they did. They were competitors as well. So the way that people respond to the brother-sister constellation is interesting. Or brother-brother, fratricide, you know, Jacob and Esau, we go back. Okay, that kind of rivalry. Who gets the blessing of the father? I mean, there's endless stories, you know. Other ways to work it out. Yes?
It seems to me if complexes and archetypes are, like, say, an end result or a process result of years and years of humans living on this earth, and if complex is related to career, or therefore the result of that, because we don't seem to fit today. The energy, in other words, that I feel.
That as I've experienced this organization, the lectures that have been here, it's one of the things that's nice is to be able to access the archetype of the wise old man or the wise old woman, the Senex energy, that it's in that place of wisdom. And we've really lost a lot of touch with that. I've been reading a number of things where they talk about just contemporary television where the parent generation is really ridiculed, fathers are put down. You know, and there's all this kind of thing where we don't access the wisdom of people who've endured and lived long and witnessed lots of change in a particular field of endeavor. And yet, in science, you know, sometimes it's the longevity that gives people those great discoveries, that they've really stuck to the tasks that they've done. I think that's not just in science, but in any field. I just remember reading in my rehab journals about people who started, you know, in different parts of the country when there were no rehab laws and they were itinerant and they went from little community to little community, you know, and helped people gradually go back to work. And they've been in the field as the laws evolved and helped to shape them and to see the kind of change, you know. So there's a lot to be said for staying in one place, but you have to, if it's not validated in the outer world, find the inner resource that acknowledges its validity. It's a real important thing.
When you said that, I thought it would depend on kind of which generation you spoke to, because there would be people who would honor that, certainly. And it also seems like things are in such transition now that we are in the process of rethinking, remaking our rituals, which is a big issue with that.
Yeah, in the back.
And one of the things I'm struggling with is to what extent is it running away from a complex, and to what extent is what one tends to want to run to is
either one of those. But I think you need to look at it in the context of that total individual. Mm-hmm. You know, and the feeling I certainly got in working with this person was it was definitely, there was a complex that was, and he was terribly frightened. And that kind of fear meant that he really hadn't resolved the relationship with that system that he was in. It was still a very much, you could feel, the dependent relationship. But sometimes, you know, it's one's neurosis that makes one do the most creative work. You know, you don't know, right?
Oh.
I guess when I think of doing this kind of work, I always think of and, rather than this or that, rather than to block a possibility. Always include and be more inclusive in my thinking about it. Otherwise, it's so easy to get judgmental and lose something that might really be of intrinsic value to the person. I'm glad you brought it out.
Better move on.
I want to say a little bit about the packets everybody got that have been sitting on your desks, and we'll move into the next section here. What we've done so far tonight is look at really the first worksheet, returning to the source and some influential factors. The second page, the way it was collated, really should be the fourth page. Exploring the landmarks should logically, we don't have to be logical, but logically should come after the lifeline, because it really asks you to look in depth at the kinds of things that you mark on there. The opening guided imagery that Joyce did gives you an idea of what might go on the lifeline. And I would encourage any, how many of you have read or looked at Women Who Run with the Wolves? Yay. Okay, there's a chapter she talks about this consos, marking the crosses of the things that died along the way. Essentially, that's a wonderful image to go with the lifeline, and so I've included both the positive and the negative. Look at the things that that have gone well for you in your life and the choice points, and look at the things that you've really had to leave behind. Okay?
And also, how many of you have read Transitions by Bridges?
There you go.
It's another excellent
the
book.
The other companion book. Those two. Okay. Some of the worksheets, what we'd like for you to do if you're coming back on Saturday is to do as many of these as you can, or do what you can, and we'll be working, spending some time to have people write and do some thinking about it then, but to prepare yourself to have some of this accomplished. And as I said, we're going over some of these things tonight, so we're going to give you a jump start on it, and then we'll be working with them on Saturday. If there are any questions so far about anything we've done, or
There will be some time on Saturday, but hopefully you will have gone through most of this so that as a group we can work as a group together and go through some of the exercises. We probably won't go through all of them, but the ones that seem most pertinent.
And if you're not coming back and you're still in the middle of change or thinking about it, do them anyway over time, as you have time to think this through, whatever's gotten started in you tonight, work with that. And Bridges' book on transitions is really an excellent companion to this. Yes.
Could you possibly go over these sheets on looking ahead and seeing one of them at least where it's not clear what I would do?
What's the name of it?
Cattle or bail response kind of.
Okay. We'll probably spend quite a bit of time, I would think, on Saturday on this one, but the kinds of things that I was just talking about the complexes. And just the things, even if you don't want to label them as complexes, things that you know that you've done yourself. When I first got up to Seattle, I thought that I wanted to major in physical therapy. And I was, in fact, I'd worked in a program, I'd been in a program in Oregon at a two-year college to that end, but I wasn't happy with the two-year program. I really wanted a professional degree. And I was volunteering with the Cerebral Palsy Society here, taking disabled adults swimming a couple of times a month, I think once a week. And I had my interview for the PT program, which is down at University Medical School in the Health Sciences building. I had my interview one day for that degree program, and I had been swimming with all these folks, and I came in my sort of hippie dress, and my hair was all wet, and essentially I sabotaged the interview. I didn't ask the therapist that I was working with for a reference and a couple of things like that. So when we get to these real crunch points in our life and we have choices and options, looking at the ways in which we do things unconsciously has an effect on where we end up, okay? Like my saying yes when the person said, have you answered the ad in the newspaper, even though I didn't know about it, also had an influence on my life. Those kinds of things. And how you respond under certain kinds of stress. I mean, I remember a track when it was sort of ending and they were going from running 6 work behavior programs in a month to not enough referrals to run 1. It was absolute disaster around there. And I know that my reactions were more out of the complex than they were out as a professional. You know, it was really a deadly time. You know, I had been for a while treated as a non-person by my supervisors. And they would walk in and they knew we weren't getting enough business, but nobody would tell me I was going to be laid off. You know, and you begin to have strange responses when you're treated for a long period of time as a non-being, you know, even though I was working real hard with the clients. And so that's the kind of thing I think that we're looking for.
Yeah, and how do you respond to stress? How do you respond to change? How many of you get sick? What are your vulnerabilities? How many of you drink a little more or sleep a little more or eat a little more, or do you have a support system that you go to? So this is the kind of, these are kind of choices that we make, sometimes conscious, sometimes unconscious, to pay attention to.
Does that help?
No.
Okay.
Do you have a more specific question?
No, it does help, but it's just kind of vague.
What really it requires is that you think about you rather than me giving you what I do under adverse conditions or healthy conditions. But you really need to look at what you do, things that work for you and things that you know further your own demise. Right? And that's individual. Some of that, when we get through working in the group, you will find is very similar, but some of it's going to be unique to you. Right? And then you can begin to see maybe some of the archetypal stuff that's underneath it too.
What do you do when the water gets rough? What do you do when it's stagnant? So those kinds of things.
Panic or go fishing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I wanted to cover tonight still was actually referring to the title of this presentation, When the River Changes Its Bed. And maybe this will answer some of those questions we've had. What kind of unconscious choices happen that force us into a change, whether we would like to have it or not? Okay.
You want me to write?
What I mean when I say unconscious choice, I mean, the layoff question has been up here, so wouldn't that be a first logical answer? People get laid off. Businesses close. Okay. Employers relocate. Any others that we can think of? Unconscious choice? Illness in the family or illness of oneself? Financial responsibility change?
Boredom.
Who said? Boredom? Boredom is an explain how you see boredom as an unconscious choice. Wellness. Okay. You want to expand on that one? What, to repeat what he just said, when one heals oneself and becomes well, there's often an unconscious attitude change toward employment about what work you can stand to do or not.
What you would like to do.
I work that both ways with the process of elimination of all. Also, there are things I will never go back to. You know, I could have had a job working in rehab in Olympia. I would wash dishes in a nursing home in Seattle before I would go take an administrative job in rehab in Olympia. It's that clear. I won't do it. You know, somebody would get hurt. I just assumed I'd be myself and my family. Okay. Anything else? Yeah, please.
How is a layoff an unconscious? And that's something that outside.
Well, it's the speaking of the collective unconscious in that instance, right? And we do get those messages from the collective that we're in the wrong place at the wrong time. Okay? And layoff is a very collective experience. And a lot of people are going through that right now with the economy. I have done job placement in some really tough economic times in this town, you know, and it really affects a lot of people. And one of the nice things about working in groups with people then is that they don't feel so alone with it, like it's only happening to me. You know, it's a collective phenomenon. And it changes individuals tremendously. Okay, a couple of other ones. I'll read from my list. People quit. They don't know why. They just up and quit. I can't stand it anymore. Sometimes they get fired. And that's a message from the unconscious, a big time message, that they aren't, something's wrong. Right? Let me get fired. Yes?
Well, having my own business, my attitude goes the wrong way. I don't see things. It doesn't come to me.
So no work. Attitude, your attitude affects the work you do.
Yeah.
So you get the message from the unconscious.
I do not have responsibility, so I have to
What I have parenthetically about fire is what shadow? Who, me? Anybody know their shadow? Anybody ever have an encounter with a shadow? A few people. There is nothing like something like that to bring you into consciousness or connection with your own unconscious attitudes. And that's usually a real big shock to the system. And some people don't get it, and so they get fired, and they get fired, and they get fired. You know, we used to work with guys that they were really God's gift to the labor force, and you just wouldn't want to be around them for very long. You know, the attitude was so abrasive and so aversive. Another kind of symptom, and it is related to your statement about boredom that I had down here, is restless. Just kind of a restlessness about what's going on. You're unhappy, but you're still there. And so that's a message from the unconscious. I used to know that when I couldn't get up in the morning on a regular basis and I had to drag myself by the arm into work, I really was, it was time to get out of there. You know? And the other one which Joyce and I encountered endlessly was injury. People got injured on the job. When it's time to change, the risk, when the unhappiness is up and the boredom is up and the restlessness is up and people don't pay attention to that, usually they end up working more overtime and the stress goes up on the job, and that's about the time a person's going to get hurt. We saw people thrown off roofs, you know, you name it, drop down holes, lifted something wrong, and they just got hurt. And that was an unconscious, had an unconscious influence on what they were then going to do with the rest of their life.
We don't have much more. It's about 1:30. Oh, no, not quite. Is that right?
Just one of that. Go over. What we're trying to figure out is how much longer. We're kind of getting to the end of the evening, and we want to get into a little bit more stuff.
Well, yeah, you just want to talk a little bit about dreams, so people bring that in, right. And so we're sort of winding down. Why don't you do that?
The other thing in terms of looking at just where we might be in these handouts. Okay. The third page, the impact of career transitions. What happens at about this time when these unconscious factors have come into play, if a person hasn't made a conscious decision to leave and to go find something else to do, but they find themselves suddenly out of work or between things, all the major questions of life surface. Where am I now? What am I now? Who am I now? Sometimes the best way to figure that out is to go back, as we've begun this evening. Where was I? What was I? Who was I? And then we can come to the questions of where am I going, what am I going to do, and who will I become? At this point in time, speaking from the relationship of the conscious to the unconscious, the old persona, the old shadow, the onum and the onimus, those of you who are all familiar with the terminology, they don't work well anymore. Pretty much the old gray mare, she ain't what she used to be. And so it's time then to reevaluate. And one enters, having left the old world, as we've been hearing all through this season on the seasons of life, one leaves the old, the known, and the familiar, and enters into that phase of initiation where you're removed from what you once knew. You enter into a time of limbo when all of these questions come up and there's more questions than there are answers. Okay, so in a very active way, we're taking all that stuff that's been coming out here through this whole series of programs and saying, this is where you find yourself now when you enter into the place of career transition and you're between jobs. You're literally in that archetypal space between worlds. You are not who you were and you are not yet who you will become. The experience during that time is a lot of chaos. So sometimes it helps just to know that there's a lot of chaos. And so you don't panic under that circumstance. Okay? But that's where we're going to ask you to spend this next week, those of you who are coming back, those of you who are contemplating this major change or in it anyway, contemplate the chaos in which you find yourself. Okay? And it's out of that point that it really helps to pay attention and listen to the psyche. I would really encourage, in addition to all of this cognitive homework, that over this next week, and perhaps for subsequent weeks, that you keep track of your dreams. How many of you do that anyway? Oh, great. Mm. Okay, so it won't be so hard. Those of you who've never done it, the first requirement is to sleep. Those of you going to school and working two jobs may not be able to do that, so you have to watch it. And just keep a paper and pencil by your bed, and you don't have to wake yourself up all through the night, but just catch whatever comes through. You know, keep your book where it's handy. If you have somebody else that you have to take consideration of in the bed so that you don't wake them, let them know that what you'll be doing, and have a place sometime during the morning where you can jot them down. Try and catch them, because they really are quite informative. What I'd like to talk about a little bit is the kind of dreams that I have seen come up during this period of time. I've worked with a lot of students who are graduating from very, very rigorous programs. As they near graduation, the dreams that come up as they're about to embark on their career path have a lot to do with rebirth. Very, very powerful symbols of regeneration. For my own self, when I left the job at Track and hadn't built my practice up to the point where it would sustain me, I found myself every Sunday reading the Sunday paper, and my husband was really, you know, you got to get a job. And I didn't know what to do, and I had a dream that I was back in New York, where I'm from, standing on the stoop of an old brownstone building. And there was a guy in the middle of the street, and he came up to me and he said, "You know that law that they passed about rounding up anybody standing in the street for loitering just so they can catch drug traffickers?" So that's a bad law, because they catch a lot of innocent people. And the message to me was it was okay to stand in the doorway and look up and down the street to see what was going on. And sometimes it's that kind of message, even when you don't know, that can guide you through this time of transition. It's really important to pay attention to what's going on in your unconscious, because that's where the reserve comes from if you're committed to making change. What happens is that the psyche in its entirety begins to be committed to that process so that you can express more aspects of the self when the old ways are really worn out. Okay. When John Muir Perry was here, anybody hear his lecture a couple of years ago? He gave a very interesting lecture. He was talking about psychosis and the program he used to run in San Francisco. And he talked about a young man who was working in Silicon Valley and came into the clinic with a psychotic break, and he kept talking about this dream that a fleet of Buddhist monks was invading San Francisco Bay. And they were trying to figure out what this was. And this guy had a job 9 to 5 in Silicon Valley, or one of those places out there on the electronics strip, and he was in engineering, I guess. And he really, really deeply wanted to go and become a monk and learn to meditate, but he was tied to this 9 to 5 job with a wife and 2.5 kids in a car and a mortgage, and he couldn't do it. He didn't think he could do it. And so the message from the unconscious that he also had a spiritual side appeared to him as just an invading army of monks, you know. And so if you can listen to the psyche, it can tell you what's most strong. And the longer you resist, the harder you close your eyes and grit your teeth against something you really want to do, the more forceful method the psyche will choose to show it to you. I call it the frying pan method, you know. Boom. It's going to come up and hit you over the back of the head. So if you're feeling a lot of tension in your body, a lot of back pain, a lot of neck pain, a lot of teeth grinding. You know, we used to see people, their heels were dug into the floor. They all had low back injuries, you know. They were just like being pulled by this bronco. That's the kind of message where you can perhaps ameliorate a little bit. A little bit like the last fairy in Sleeping Beauty, you know, after the curse is cast on Sleeping Beauty that she'll die. Well, they just soften the blow and she can do it for, she can sleep for 100 years. You know, if you can listen, perhaps you can soften the kind of impact that life might have in store if you're really full out resisting. You can't always, we don't know what that's about. But also these things change you and they open your eyes to other possibilities.
So do what makes sense in the exercises we gave you, and some of them may seem very relevant and some may not, and that's okay. If you want to do all of them, fine, and if you don't have a lot of time, we'll have some time on Saturday And then we'll meet and go through that packet.
And I have, and I hope we get some time to spend with some of the, what I would call, how many of you know what type you are? People know types? Okay. Anybody real sensation-focused type? A lot of intuitives and feelers? We're going to spend time with your inferior function. So we're going to talk about that, because I've got lots of data from my old life. Books and things and, you know, paper and pencil stuff, and you can look at numbers and you can look at forms, and we'll work with some of that on Saturday.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.